Hey folks, before we get to our next episode, I wanted to ask you to consider leaving a tip at my website, wordballoon.com, and joining what I'm calling the League of Word Balloon Listeners. Now that we're entering our seventh year of Word Balloon Podcasts and being a broadcast guy, I've avoided doing a pay subscription model for the show. But the reality is there are production costs. Whether it's updating equipment, traveling to conventions for more guest interviews and panels, or frankly earning something for the effort of producing 12 to 15 hours of show content every month. I know it's a tough economy. That's why I'm happy to keep the show a free product as long as possible. But if you can swing a couple dollars, do me a favor. Go to the front page of wordballoon.com, hit the PayPal button that will provide a Dropbox, and give what you can. As always, thank you for your support. In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here, a good double feature. First up, the DC Vice Presidents Bob Wayne and John Cunningham report in to talk about the April numbers and also the introduction of DC's second wave into the New 52. Then we switch gears and talk with Mike Avon Oeming. Mike is back full-time in comic books and has a lot of product coming out in the weeks ahead. We talk about his fine work coming up for Dark Horse Presents, also a new series called The Victories for Dark Horse, new editions of Powers starting with issue 12, the title changes to Powers FBI, and Mike talks about that. We also talk about the current status of the Powers pilot and how it is in redevelopment right now at FX. Plus, as always, we like to talk about mythology with Mike, and we get into an interesting conversation of what he considers to be modern mythology. It's not the superhero world. It's something different. But a great conversation with Mike Oeming right here on Word Balloon. Today, it's brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Lots of great deals going on at InStockTrades.com. 45% off all DC comics and 50% off DC archives. You can get the hardcover of Volume 1 of Batman, The Court of Owls for 50% off, just $12.49. Avengers, Private War of Dr. Doom, the hardcover, 40% off, just $17.99. You can get Hulk, Return of the Monster, Bruce Jones and Mike Deodato, the premium hardcover, 40% off, $17.99. Or Ben Templesmith and Ben McCool's Choker, a great Image book, Volume 1, 38% off, $10.53, all at InStockTrades.com. Don't forget, if your orders are $50 or more, you receive free shipping. Check out all the deals they are waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. All right, it's time for our usual monthly catch-up with Bob Wayne and John Cunningham, the DC Vice Presidents, talking about the numbers and more. And we start things off with them on Word Balloon. Gentlemen, it was great seeing you at C2E2, and welcome back to the air. I'm sorry that John Rood couldn't be with us, but John Cunningham, it's a pleasure to have you back as well as Bob. Thank you, guys.
Great to be back. Happy to be here.
Let's talk quickly about C2E2 before we get into the April numbers. How was the feedback in terms of the DC announcements made, and how did things go at the retailer summit?
The show itself, I think, was very pleasing to us. We were very happy to see Reed have a bigger attendance this year and have the show come off bigger, and I think that figured in to the responses that we saw while we were at the show. And being there, I think you know that before Watchmen was a big, big part of what our focus on the show was, and I think all of the attention that we got, and especially the standing room only panel that we had, the enthusiasm we felt from people was enormous. Many of them were extremely gratified and enthused by the amount of energy they got from the fans at the show.
John, I wanted to ask you very quickly, you gave a good presentation at the retailer dinner about the Nielsen ratings, and I had one follow-up question on that. Will there be a follow-up survey to see where trends may have changed from those initial plans of the first issue purchase to whatever time period there might be a second survey?
Yeah, we're working out the details with Nielsen right now. Literally, as I've been on these interviews, I've been working out details. But it's always been our intent not just to do one survey and sort of get that snapshot view of where the market is at one point in time. It's critical for us to continue to do this over the long term so that we can measure the effect of what we're doing and see what changes, if any, are occurring in the marketplace. So we'll have some more news on this shortly, but it's not surprising when I say I think that the intent has always been there to make this an ongoing look at the marketplace.
Bob, you know, the April numbers came out, and again, I think in this eighth month, or I should say, I guess after 7 months, you know, still strong showing in the top 10, a little bit more even with Marvel, given the debut of Avengers versus X-Men. So it seems like, you know, April might have been a month where you guys had adjusted expectations. I would think going into this month, though, with the second wave of new DC titles, that you're looking at more of a even playing field with them in the midst of an event early on, and you guys debuting some very significant books with the second wave.
Well, at the same time, we'll also have the first collections of the new 52.
Yes.
Just started going on sale on Wednesday of this week, so we'll have all of those really strong books on the charts as well. Yeah, we're very optimistic and excited about how the May charts are going to look. And then we already know from the initial orders that we're going to be very competitive in June with the four Watchmen titles.
Yeah, I was curious about some pre-order figures that have come out, especially considering the last time we talked specifically about how a guy like Rob Liefeld was taking over three books. And it was interesting to note that, in particular, Hawkman and Deathstroke numbers pre-orders seem to go up, maybe, you know, given the some of the subjects that he said he might be covering in the books and the fact that there was this creative change. And I was wondering if you wanted to comment on that.
Dan and Jim, you know, were interested in getting Rob's enthusiasm and ideas and energy into those books. We seem to have had an uptick on those titles in advance of people actually seeing a lot of the stuff. So we're really optimistic on those, as well as we are, you know, the Culling storyline that goes through the Teen Titans, mm-hmm. Superboy, and the Night of the Owls, and that, you know, just all this continuing excitement, the second wave titles, the collections, the Before Watchmen. We think we've got a whole lot of really cool stuff coming out all right now, and we're really optimistic about it.
Also, I'm wondering, we heard about Zero Issues coming up in the fall. And I'm wondering what you can tell us about those. It seems like there's a place that, you know, maybe storylines will be adjusted for those Zero Issues to obviously be an entry point for some people. There's a lot of speculation going on what those Zero Issues might look like. What can you tell us about those projects?
I don't think we can tell you anything about those. John, do we have anything we want to tell him about those?
I don't even know what he's talking about. I've heard nothing internally about any Zero Issues.
Yeah, I mean, I hope he doesn't mean that we're putting out Zero Issues one month, as in no issues at all. That would be awful.
Aren't there? Am I nuts, guys? Or are you toying with me? It seems like you're toying with me. All right, I hear laughing. You're toying with me. That's all right. Well, honestly, I was wondering because, again, it looks like we might see, and don't get me wrong, I think these second wave books are very interesting and everyone's going to be looking at them. I've read three of them so far. I thought they were great. Loved Smallville, loved Earth 2, and World's Finest. I think those are really strong. Can't wait to get to Dial H for Heroes. It's just work schedules kept me from reading it so far. And the same goes with GI Combat and things like that. But it almost seems like in the fall we might see another wave coming. Is that a fair speculation?
It's speculation, I'll give you that.
All right.
When we get to the fall, we'll find out if you were being fair to us or if you were, you know, overreaching.
All right, understood. Well, here, how about some stuff that has come out and has been announced in previews? Bob, I was wondering with some of the showcases that are coming up, really glad to have seen the Spectre and All-Star Squadron come back. I think those are really great stories from the past, and I know there's been a lot of clamor to get Roy Thomas's All-Star Squadron back in print. I think the Spectre stuff speaks for itself. That was really, I mean, well, we're getting almost everything from the Spectre pre John Ostrander and now I'm blanking on who was the awesome artist in that 80s Spectre series. It's, you know, but anyway, I think
Tom Mandrake did
Tom Mandrake. That's exactly right. Thank you, sir. And no, that's great. And also, I know the Adam Strange there's a showcase coming up that's going to take Showcase from number one. That's really interesting to see. And I noticed a couple other previews of some of the old Silver Age stuff coming back and everything. Was the delay on those things just because you want to roll these things out slowly? Or I had also heard that you guys wanted to make sure that, you know, people who might get, you know, royalties from this kind of thing were properly represented and you'd got the right creators so that before you release something, you wanted to make sure all that information was straight?
I think it's probably all of the above. That, you know, we always want to make sure that we're in touch with people, we've worked out compensation, and we also, you know, want to make sure that some of these things reflect what we're doing or not doing within our publishing plan. You know, there's the Spectre's not really seen a lot right now, but it's good to have a showcase out there to let people remember what they thought was cool about the character. And as you said, that is a very inclusive showcase. I think John Cunningham and I were, you know, watching, you know, and Dan DiDio coming through, you know, when our copies first came in, he was, you know, definitely, it was like watching a young comic fan going through something for the first time.
The other thing I'd add to that is, all those things that you listed off may well be factors on any given showcase or any archival book we do, but one of those factors that doesn't really get a lot of airplay because it's not necessarily the sexiest thing to talk about is the kind of work that goes on in restoration, making sure we have a good reproducible page, making sure those things are all done. Those little factoids play an enormous factor in the timing of some of these things. It's just not something we talk about a lot because it's when you start talking about production details, I think there's a directly proportional response to audience reaction, the more detailed you get. But it is fascinating if you're in the publishing game to see some of the work that our collected editions people have to do to get those books ready.
In the showcase or even some of these other volumes, did you have to go back to private collectors to get good copies of some of these books?
I wouldn't go that far, only because I'm not aware of those, but that's a great point, and if that is the case, we'll make our publicity people aware, and they can do something with that story.
Well, one other thing, or two things I wanted to bring up quickly. Interesting to see Mad go to a trade, Mad Magazine go to kind of a trade collection, and I know that's coming up. Is it this month, the first kind of Mad Quarterly that looks more like a trade paperback versus the magazine?
Well, we've been doing those without a lot of fanfare for a while, since the success of the TV show and Cartoon Network. And, you know we're going to continue to do those probably 3 a year is our current plan.
Okay. And, John, I was wondering, we've heard a lot in the comics community reaction to Before Watchmen, both positive and negative. But how about outside of the direct market? Has there been any feedback? I mean, obviously, there's been a ton of articles written, but is there any way of gauging audience excitement or anticipation or even possibly a negative reaction to the project? I was wondering, though, as far as outside of the Wednesday Warriors, what the reaction has been to Before Watchmen.
I think if you want to talk about outside the Beltway, the anecdote that I would give you is Bob and I are also involved when we meet with the sales group at Random House, who does our book trade distribution into the general market. And, you know, those guys are used to working up to a year behind what we're doing in periodical publication. But we've been very open with them as we've learned over time and talking about what's happening on the periodic side before we get to them, because it sort of works as a pre-sell in the book market. All I can say is at the last two Random House sales meetings that we had, their palpable enthusiasm for this. They're hearing it from their customers already. And on the book trade side, they look at it from a numerical point of view and see the numbers they've sold over the last 5 years on the original Watchmen and know that they have a chance here to do something special next year when those books go into trade. So that's another factor that sales and marketing can look at in advance of publication, where we get that sense of how it's working in the rest of the world.
Sounds good. Well, guys, I see that our time is limited, so I'll wrap up and say congratulations on another good April, and we'll see how the second wave does. When we get the May numbers back, and then certainly in June before Watchmen begins. And I think that's when the real battle begins. But I have a feeling that both sides are armed to the teeth, and it'll be a good month for comics in general.
You say battle, and we say fun.
There you go. Attaboy. Exactly. Let's all win. I think that's a great attitude. No, honestly,
exactly.
Guys, good talking to you both, and looking forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Time to turn to the independent side of things and a great conversation with Mike Avon Oeming. It's been far too long. I can't believe it's been since 2007, the last time we had Mike solo. Of course, we were able to celebrate the 10th anniversary with Powers, with him and Brian Bendis at Baltimore Comic Con. But after long promises and many conventions, it's good to have Mike back. We have a nice long conversation. And much like some of my other favorite guests, it's always fun to talk trivia and some other nonsense outside of comics, so we get into that. But Mike has a good story about coming back to comics, and we present it here now on Word Balloon.
Well, good, man. I'm glad we're able to do this. I'm sorry it's been so long. No, cool, man. Well, I probably haven't had that much to say in the last couple of years, so this is good. It's good timing.
I understand. Are we cool? Can we jump right in?
Yeah.
Okay, because I want to talk about that. You were kind of outside of Powers, and then obviously went on to a bit of an irregular schedule. You've been away, and you were kind of out, you know, working for computer games, right?
Yeah.
Video games, excuse me.
Well, I was working for a video game company called Valve Corporation, and they're famous for creating Half-Life, Portal, Left 4 Dead, Counter-Strike, and a couple of things. And they're a company that's basically all creator-owned, in a sense, because they're not a company like EA or something like that, or Sony, that outsources their work and stuff. You know, they're a company that actually owns and distributes their own work. So while I was there, to work on comics. They're very interested in expanding their IP world by explaining it through various fiction, including comics. And we did a bunch of comics for Team Fortress and a giant one for Left 4 Dead. Portal, and then we were trying to work on a couple other ones.
Cool. Good experience?
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was 3 years of all the art school that I never got as a kid. I was very lucky. I got to work with extremely talented people who, you know, I learned a lot being there. They learned a lot about making comics and language of comics. There are people who are natural comic book writer and artists there already, guys like Jay Pinkerton and Eric Walpaw, great, amazing writers who we did most of the comics with. They pretty much wrote most of the stuff there. An artist named Andrea Wickland, she did half the Portal artwork. And she had never done a graphic novel before, and if you look at that, or a comic book before, and if you look at the Portal thing that we did, it's as good as anything that Vertigo has ever done, and it was her first gig as, you know, doing sequential art, and it was just amazing. So I got to learn tons of stuff from these people. I went in knowing nothing about visual art other than how to scan in a page and drop my blacks in. And
okay.
By the end of the Left 4 Dead story that we did, I was drawing it completely digitally. And I just, now I've become pretty proficient with digital comics or digital art forms, and I mix it up and stuff. And just learned a ton of stuff there. I learned how to letter. I learned how to color. They got to do a bunch of comics, and it was good.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, go on. Go on, please.
I was just saying, I mean, ultimately, I think we both the company and I just reached a point where we just couldn't really do anything different. You know, the comics were largely sort of ads for the comics, and I think I wanted a lot more out of it than that. And they were really
ads for the game.
Yeah, kind of like okay. They filled in the sort of blank spots, the gaps in between stories and stuff.
Okay.
Most of them are actually just for updates for Team Fortress. And I really wanted to do the comics full time there, and they were pretty interested in doing that, but they also wanted me to expand and do some animation and stuff. But as I was there, I realized I was more useful being a great comic book artist as opposed to learning how to be a great animator next to guys who, you know, work for Pixar and stuff.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
But that's interesting though, and I can appreciate that feeling. So, is what you learned animation wise, are there things that you can apply to other projects and stuff? Because I know, you know, we've talked before. You've made independent films and stuff like that, and I know as much
well,
as you're.
Well, let's not fool anybody. Let's not call any of that independent films. That was.
that was
miles away from that.
All right, fine. Even like at the level of student film, dicking around with a camera, but actually, no, trying to do some stuff and everything. So, you know, but obviously it sounds like, you know, you really want to focus on, you know, what you do best, I guess, as a comic book artist.
Yeah, absolutely. I played around with the tools, learning to do sort of pre-viz stuff with 3D models and whatnot. And ultimately, the whole time I just kept thinking, I should just draw this, you know. But, you know, we were very interested in developing tools they're serious about comics, not just doing comics for themselves, but in developing tools and languages to find what the new frontier of comics are. So there's a lot of tools that they're developing that I wouldn't talk about, but they're taking very seriously. I wouldn't be surprised if we see some programs coming out of them and in the future. But I learned lots. I learned how to be a better artist there, a better writer, a better, faster storyteller, learned how to use all kinds of new tools and stuff. So, and also got me out to the West Coast, which I'm very, very grateful of.
That's excellent. Yeah. So are you like, and we don't want to pinpoint you, but are you in the Seattle area? Are you in the Portland area?
Yeah, right next to Seattle is an artificial little city called Bellevue. and it's largely like an outdoor mall. It looks like if they could have afforded to film here when they were making Logan's Run, they would have filmed it here in the 70s. It's just, you know, it's like it's super clean, all these skyscrapers that are just immaculate and very safe and no personality and very nice. We like it here for the safety and cleanness aspect.
Okay. Well, that's good. No, and I'm really glad your upcoming output, including what you're currently doing too. Dude, there is honestly, I think outside of Western, there isn't a genre that you are about to, you know, have a little sprinkling in, from Takeo to your creator-owned stuff, Powers, and even Hulk Smash. So I want to start with, like, Takeo is coming out this week, and will likely, isn't it the first issue?
Yeah. Yep.
Very cool.
First regular, like, floppy issue. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's cool, man. I've talked to Brian about it and everything, but give me your two cents on, you know, the idea when Brian said, "Hey, I want to do this," and you know, I know Olivia kind of helped birth the project, but you tell me your point of view on Takeo.
You know, it really just developed like any of our other projects, which, you know, outside of Powers, Brian and I have some other creator-owned stuff that's on the horizon outside of Powers and Takeo. And all these projects always come out of just sort of conversations, talking about what we enjoy and what these ideas are. And then we'll eventually go, you know what, let's pursue this and see more of it. And like even when Olivia first started talking about her and my wife Taki as adoptive superheroes, we would go down and visit them in Portland, and Olivia and Taki have a really tight bond group, you know, they're got a good friendship going on and stuff. And
very cool.
She developed this idea, and then Brian started talking to her and like picking her brain and bouncing stuff off of Olivia. And Olivia, having grown up in a house full of creative people who put emphasis on reading and the deciphering what they watch, asking questions, Olivia is a very smart little girl and had excellent ideas, shockingly good ideas. Like not just like cute stuff where you go, "Oh, that's so cute, she came up with this idea." It was good stuff. I mean, she came up with her superpowers and the way they work. And then from there, her and Brian developed the story and then, you know, bounced it off of me and stuff. And I worked with Olivia on the costumes, which was really fun. I drew like these outlines of Olivia and Taki, and then we kind of filled in characters almost like a coloring book to, you know, find the designs.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it developed like that. And, we're very excited that it's something that anybody could read. I'm super excited that, you know, I'd be working on Powers 1 week and working on Takeo the next week, two completely books in every sense of the word, and not just in tone, not just because one is an adult book and one is suitable for anybody to read, but style-wise, I was doing a single line weight thing with Takeo and then doing heavy, thick noir stuff on Powers. So it was total gear shifts in between each project, and I really enjoy that.
It's great, too, to watch you in these two different genres because it's still you, Mike. I mean, everyone can see that, but you're right. Even subconsciously, those choices and everything really do come through and do make them different. But it is awesome that – because when some others, you know, try to cross genres and stuff, think of really even like the classic guys like Frazetta and stuff like that. His funny animal stuff is so different. But it's so nice that your stuff – you know, you're able to keep your signature through and it still fits in, like I said, as something as dark as the noir stuff of Powers, but also this light Takeo stuff too.
Thanks. Well, I think each of those projects kind of informs the other. I still feel like the same artist when I'm drawing Takeo and when I'm drawing Powers. I'm just using different rendering styles.
Okay.
And bouncing back and forth between different things really makes you grow as an artist. And I'm convinced... Now, Frank Frazetta is one of my favorite artists. He's one of my most – he's not literally most influential, but, I mean, he was one of the artists I was looking for before I was even looking at comics. I had one of his like fantasy books, and I was just, you know, sucked into the world that he created. And a lot of it had to do with, it's not just his painting style or his rendering style, but it's how he captures action and motion. Like an animator, you know, it's fluid on the page. And I think it has a lot to do with, because of his years as a cartoonist, doing that really cartoony stuff. And I think that's the stuff that informed his painting years later, which is why he could capture, you know, an axe ready to come down at just, he's capturing it at like the perfect moment where there's the most kinetic energy that he can capture in a painting. And I think that came out of him doing the really cartoony stuff, because when you're doing that cartoony stuff, you have to do the exaggerated actions, and then you throw it into a realistic painting like Frazetta was doing, and you get magic. You get the best of
that. That's really cool. Have you been getting any of those Vanguard books of, you know, the 40s and 50s Frazetta stuff?
No, because largely I've got most of his work, and...
Oh, okay.
Well, this also comes to another point. I'm sure we'll talk about the digital revolution of comics and media later on, but I've moved so much in the last couple of years, and my wife, Taki, is also an artist, and when we met, two artists with all your books, all of your comics, all of your reference books. I mean, it's incredible. I'd say a quarter of our stuff when we first moved out here was comics and reference, like just huge amount of stuff. Yeah, so what's happened over the years, like once we got iPads, we really have to think hard about buying a book. It has to be. It's a pretty big decision, because we've gotten everything down to basically two bookshelves, and we've got some comics and boxes, and that's it. So when I see those giant Frazetta books, you know, I just want to run away. Because I like having my space back. I like not, you know, when I move, not having to break my back or spend an extra $1,000 to move the books. I like my space back. I love books, but I'm also enjoying having space and not feeling like, I'm being ruled by my possessions. I will say the last big book I did buy was a really large. There's two of them. One was Eric Canetti's art book, which is amazing,
and
the IDW Parker stuff that Darwin Cook did. Those are really big, oversized art books, and I had to think very hard about buying them.
Is that the Martini edition? I haven't gotten it yet. If that's the case,
the IDW one.
The Parker, yeah, Parker, is it the collection of the two books? Is it that big slipcase kind of?
Yeah, it's that one, yeah.
I gotcha. Yeah, I bought the singles when they've come out, obviously, because, yeah, I can't wait. But I do keep meaning to go back and get that Martini edition. And now I've got the third coming out, too, I know. No, I can appreciate that, man. Yeah, I can appreciate that, too, with the old stuff, because I do hope that, you know, there's a plan digitally for that stuff, as nice as it does look on your shelf and stuff like that. It would be nice to, you know, always have access. And I'm sure somebody very smart will do that. But,
well, one of the things that I started to, and I haven't done one of my first edit books. I simply just gave most of my art books away to other people. But what I would do with my reference books is I learned how to use my scanner properly. Finally,
uh-huh.
I discovered that. Discovered after having it for 4 years that there's a hand feeder where we'll just automatically scan everything. So I would take all my reference books, like Poe's bio books. These books that cost $70 and took years to find and accumulate. And then I had to painfully cut them apart with a razor blade and then put the pile of pages on the hand feeder and then scan them in. And now I've got all my reference with me, dozens of books, all on my iPhone, all on my iPad. All at my computer, my PC, all at my fingertips now. No longer stored away in boxes and bookshelves and stuff. And I only wish they would make a larger iPad for better viewing of stuff like a Rosetta book. You know, because I've got a bunch of those images, just download them off the internet. You know, just pictures that are up there. But you know, they'd be better larger than what an iPad. That's the only downside for me.
I have a feeling I'm sure they'll be adjusting sizes as time goes on. You know,
yeah,
we're
like
still in those first couple of years.
Yeah, I like to see more art books digitally too. I think Dark Horse is the only company doing digital art books. Even art magazines, you can't find them digitally. Comics are surprisingly far ahead of the curve in the digital revolution than any of the other publishers, including big leading art books that I assumed were going to be online, and they're not. Stuff like Juxtapose is a very forward-thinking art book, art magazine, and they use a lot of digital art that you can't, you know, that they're not visually available. Or they are, but I think they're either them or another art book I was looking at magazine was available, but it was like in the worst possible way. It was obviously like half bought and barely put together correctly and stuff. So comics are actually, for as much complaining as we can make about our business choices, we're way ahead of the game over most publishers.
Interesting. Well, you know, it's that limited market too. I guess we'll see what happens with art books. But I want, I should, as we're speaking digitally, do you have a Cintiq? What tools are you using digitally? I'm sure a bunch of artists would like to know.
Well, when I got to Valve, one of the first things they did, somebody had become a good friend of mine, a guy named Bay Rate, put me in front of this giant, weird, flat computer, and I couldn't figure out what the hell it was. And it was a Cintiq 21-inch or 22-inch Cintiq thing, where you can draw, instead of like a Wacom tablet, which was the little tablet that's on the side of the, you know, like in your lap.
Yep.
And
yep.
What you look at is happening is on your, you know, on your computer screen. For an old school guy like me, that was too much of a disconnect, and I could barely do anything with that. But with the Cintiq, just drawing right on the screen, and it feels just as natural as it does working on paper, if you're working on a very smooth paper, almost like vellum or something. And my first day of the drawing on there, it took me an entire day to do like a single figure, and it was pretty shaky and horrible. And it took me a little while to get used to, but I ended up buying my own after maybe 2-3 months and just becoming super attached to it. Taki and I have bought several tablets. Like, there's a couple PC ones. We have a Mac modbook for traveling and drawing digitally. We've got the big Cintiq, and we've got several traveling tablets to work on digitally, which Taki's a little more into drawing digitally than I am with I guess she's inking mostly digitally, and I kind of go back and forth. Most of my inks I'm doing on a regular brush. I go back and forth between the two things.
That's really cool, man, and I can appreciate that. I know in broadcasting, going from analog tape to digital wasn't, you know, it took an adjustment and stuff. But then, you know, yeah, once I got comfortable, then it was terrific, and you appreciate the advantages and the easy way to correct and things like that. So that's cool, man. I think that's great. And I think, like you said, your experience is only helping you get better tools. And, you know, I'm curious to see, what we see on paper. Have we already seen your post, video game work?
Like, I'm trying to remember what issue it was. There was an issue of Powers that I drew completely digitally. And I think it's issue 8. I think it is. I'm not completely sure, but so that's been digital. A lot of my backgrounds, what I'll do is I'll separate my reference and draw them separately. So a lot of my backgrounds are digitally drawn. I kind of mix it up. It also depends on the mood at the time. Sometimes there's a trap with digital stuff that you think it's always going to be easier. Sometimes it's just easier to just draw it the old-fashioned way, but you'll get caught up at the moment when you're doing a page, but, I could be done now if I just draw this digitally later. And then you're sitting there drawing it digitally later, right now you're just going, why the fuck didn't I just draw this the first time? it's just like any other tool. It's got its pluses and its minuses. I'm always kind of driven a little mad when I hear other artists say that if they put digitally drawn stuff down completely, without any forethought. And it's always because they're pointing at the worst examples of it, and they're like, I can always tell when art's drawn digitally. I'm like, well, of course you can, because you're looking at the bad stuff. And I don't mean bad art-wise, but bad translation-wise. The guys who are drawing digitally that you don't even know, you don't know, unless they tell you.
Sure.
That guys like Mobius, and Mobius was drawing digitally. I don't know how much of it he did digitally, but he was, there's footage of him working on a Wacom.
Fantastic.
Brian Bolland was inking digitally way before any of us knew it was possible.
Wow, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Man, I like these tangents. All right, I want to ask you very quickly. Were you at Stumptown?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was down at Stumptown.
Did they have that Mobius film there? Did you watch that at all? Or?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Was there? I didn't know about this. I didn't know there was a film or anything.
I thought there was some sort of tribute to Mobius at Stumptown, but that's what when you said Mobius, that's what made me think of it and everything.
Okay.
So were you influenced by Mobius and everything? Because I could certainly see it if that's the case.
I definitely was influenced by Mobius. You can see some of that still if you can find copies of Ship of Fools. There's a little bit of Mobius stuff
sure.
in there. There's some of my earlier stuff you could see.
How about when you did Thor? Because I honestly thought you did this cosmic Thor what if story, and I kind of saw a kinship to Mobius' Silver Surfer in that.
There was a couple design elements for sure when it comes to space and cosmic stuff. I'm always thinking Kirby and Mobius, and I try not to just do that, but that is kind of what's in the back of my mind. And Mobius was one of those guys early on, like Frazetta, that. I remember reading Dark Horse Presents, and they had some Mobius stuff in it when I was a kid. I think I was like 12 or 13. And it was so – I didn't know that Mobius was a European artist. I didn't know what, European art was, comics. I just knew it was different, and it was awesome, and it caught my imagination and engaged my mind in a way that nothing else did. And it still does. I mean, you could still look at a Mobius piece and just stare at it all day.
Well, that's what I like about your style of art, Mike, because I think when you go big – it has that classic – there's a classic spine to your cartoony style.
Okay.
And I feel that when you do stuff. And that's why I think it's really interesting, that combination of Bigfoot and intricate detail that I think you bring to your art and stuff. And at least, again, I think that's the final effect. It always feels deeper, and it's cool because it's still cartoony, and I think that's interesting.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. I mean, I can only really, give credit to the things that influenced me, the people that influenced me, and the experiences that brought me to those places. But I appreciate that. Thank you.
Very cool. And it's always fun watching you deal with mainstream Marvel. And I know it's only one issue, but Hulk Smash with you and Fred Van Lente, when I read that you guys were doing the issue, I'm like, that's really cool. And it's interesting, too, that it's the Red Hulk. But tell me about that issue and what it felt like.
That was just a lot of fun. It's a whole issue of fighting, interrupted by some pages of Iron Man and Bruce Banner having conversation through Hulk prison glass and stuff. And it was really fun, just drawing guys beating each other up and straight, hardcore superhero fun like I haven't seen or even played around with since I was really young. And Ares was in there, so it was really fun to finally get to draw Ares a little bit.
Very cool.
The other vendors and stuff. It was just a lot of fun. And that followed up the two issues of Black Panther. This was all almost immediately after I left Valve. I just went over to Marvel and was like, hey, what do you got? And I hadn't really drawn very much for Marvel over the years, and I realized that, and I was like, I want to kind of dip my toe in there and have fun with these toys.
That's cool. So how many issues of Black Panther? Two issues?
Yeah. It was.
When are they coming up?
They already came out. They're in like 527, 528, something like
oh.
that. Yeah. In fact, I just in the mail got a trade paperback. It's the very last arc of Black Panther.
Was this Dave Liss's stuff?
Yeah, I was working with David Liss and following up Francesco on there. And,
that's fantastic. Honestly, I have to confess that I went to trades on that, and I haven't picked – if the new trade is out, I haven't picked it up yet. But, no, I really enjoyed that run of David Liss, and much like Francesco, no, I'm excited to see your stuff when it is in trade. So I'm sorry I missed it, but I look forward to it. That's,
well,
that's terrific.
I think it must just be coming out because I got it in the mail today, so it's probably this week or next week.
Okay, fantastic. And honestly, I wanted to ask about the Hulk because it kind of is a – continuity implant to Loebs and McGinnis and all the other artists that worked on the Red Hulk story. And I know obviously a writer goes back and, has to obviously read it to kind of fit the tone and have it be able to slip in. Do artists do that as well? Did you go back and, read any of the Red Hulk stuff beyond getting, his features down, but to get a feel for the story so that your thing kind of can mesh in?
Honestly, that sounds like the smarter thing to do, but no, I didn't. I jumped into it. But part of that is because I know that my style is not like a mainstream Marvel style, so that my issue is definitely just going to stick out a little bit, and there's no point in me trying to match, you know, like an Epic Guinness tone or anything like that. So I just had fun just drawing the characters. Unfortunately, I think I figured out how to draw the Hulk by the time I was just about on the last page. That's when I started to get comfortable drawing the Hulk.
He's hard, man.
He's not an easy character to draw. He's got proportional issues that are just really, take a little longer to grasp than your average superhero.
Interesting. No, I can see that. Well, regardless, like I said, I really enjoyed that What If Thor story that you did, and that's why, you know, this is
one of my favorite things that I've ever done. Most of my work I can just accept, and I'm like, okay, you know, that happened. There's a handful of things like the Spirit issue and that particular thing, a couple issues of Powers, and that What If that was written by Robert Kirkman. Some of my stuff that I'm really, really proud of, and I do really like that. That What If Thor was a lot of fun.
That's cool. I forgot about your Spirit issue. That was another good one, man. When I talked to Brian, it came up on one of the Bendis tapes, and because when else do I talk to Brian? And then but we were talking about the Dick Tracy project that never happened. I'm telling you, it was such a smart choice for you, because you've got that cartoony style in the way that Gould kind of melded Bigfoot with Littlefoot action and everything.
Well, hopefully, you know, the reason that would have worked wasn't simply because of sort of my cartoony style, but the way you could easily marry Dick Tracy in with a slightly more noir feel while still maintaining what Dick Tracy is.
Sure.
And I think that's what would have been pretty special about it. But I forget why it didn't come together. I think it was weird contractual stuff with the film rights or something like that.
Yeah, it's all the Warren Beatty stuff. Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, Warren Beatty decided to run around the parking lot dressed as Dick Tracy with a camera just to show that he still had intention of keeping the copyright or something bizarre like that.
Yeah, and that's kind of literally what the videotape was in court. And the judge is like, yeah, there you go. He's working on it.
I would love to see that.
Absolutely. But no, yeah, it was really disappointing. Did you ever read any of Max Collins and
I mean, that would have been so fun to do, because it's such a deep and rich world. I mean, there's a million characters. And, you know, the levels of the sort of maze-like city that took place in would have been amazing to be part of.
That's really cool, man. No, it's a shame that didn't happen. But we got Hulk Smash at the end of the month, so that's cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. And then we get into some of your creator-owned stuff, and I appreciated you sending me a preview of the thing you did for Dark Horse, and I'm sorry I'm bringing it up right now, but it sounds like it was a very personal story, and I want to ask about it.
Oh, sure. Well, there's two things that was going on for Dark Horse almost at the exact same time, because they were written around the same period, so they are kind of sister projects, and one was for Dark Horse Presents, I think issue 15 and 16 or 14 and 15, called The Wild
July.
Rover.
Yes. Tell me about Wild Rover. This is some heavy stuff, man. That's interesting. Well, you know, honestly, and I think of like Cross Bronx or Bronx Cross with Ivan?
Cross Bronx, yeah, with Ivan.
Yeah, Cross Bronx. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the last time I saw you get really, really dark outside of, you know, certain power stories and stuff. And this obviously it seems like a bit more personal and everything, Wild Rover.
Yeah. So while I was working at Valve, one of the things I was still doing comics, despite the fact that Powers was on a kind of a hiatus. I was still drawing it while it was on hiatus, because we had scripts and stuff like that. You know, I was working on other comics projects, and I have an unfortunate amount of confidence in the way that I work, which is I like to work 24/7. I like to constantly be drawing, whether it's work or it's, you know, just relaxing. So the idea of going to an office and drawing at an office for 8 hours and then going home and then drawing for 4 or 5 hours didn't seem like an issue to me. It didn't seem like it would be any different than anything else. But not ever having worked in an office before, I had no idea what an office environment was like, or what it was like, you know, working with other people. And while that was a great working experience, as far as an office goes, it was still just something way outside of my bounds, and I obviously bit off way more than I could chew. And I did it for 3 years. And during that time period, I wouldn't say I was having any sort of nervous breakdown, but I was definitely under a huge amount of stress that I didn't even realize was happening at the time. So I went through, it kind of triggered a lot of other sort of problems and stuff, and I started going to therapy. And one of the great things about being an artist is when you do have problems, you can put them down on paper. You can take advantage of that and tell a better, deeper story. So while during that time period, or just after, is when I came up with Wild Rover and this other series called The Victories, which
yes.
will be coming out in August.
So Wild Rover, again, I mean, Victories, you know, and all I've seen is the promotional art and everything.
I thought I sent you the first issue. Sorry about that.
That's okay, man. I was looking for it tonight, too, but I had Wild Rover, and I read it, the whole thing of Wild Rover. Yeah, well, talk about both of these. Now, Wild Rover, I mean, really has this kind of very Vertigo look. And, you know, Michael Zulli, I don't even know if it's out yet or not, but I happen to see his latest project. And that, don't get me wrong, was much more insane. But there's this kind of cool Lovecraftian kind of piece of Wild Rover that's wrapped into, you know, some serious, you know, dealings with alcoholism and kind of getting mm-hmm. into yourself and everything. So, yeah. I mean, is this semi-autobiographical in a sense? And
yeah,
I mean, how
the therapy thing and Wild Rover and Victories kind of kicked off a new direction of creator-owned stuff that I'm doing now, that I kind of calling it true fiction. So usually it's starting out with real events that happened to me or real issues I'm going through. And then, of course, they're getting fictionalized. And then by the time they're coming out, some of it's about me, some of it's not, some of it's just where the character goes and stuff. So when you're reading either of these aren't biographical pieces.
Okay.
They were certainly influenced by that. And, you know, events that I went through. Wild Rover is largely about a lot of my mother issues. She struggled with alcohol all of her life, and was involved in a lot of drug abuse and heavy, heavy depression. So by the time I was a teenager, by the time I started like getting into comics and drawing comics, I was taking care of my mother while I was going to school and you know, drawing, and all my formative years of comics and stuff were very tied into her depression and her struggles after alcohol abuse, and then going into pharmaceutical abuse and all kinds of crazy stuff. And a lot of those issues I just, you know, I dealt with and I felt comfortable with. And I think during the period where I was going through therapy, a lot of those issues, while they were wounds that healed, they weren't issues that ever went away. And I found ways to bring that out into the story. And particularly Wild Rover, because that was written during a period where there was a lot of drinking going on in my own life, which is something that I would always kind of keep a handle on because of my mother's history. In fact, I really didn't start drinking until I was in my mid-20s because I was so aware of the issue and so paranoid that it could ever be a problem. So it wasn't until, you know, I would have a couple of drinks here and there over a couple years of time that I even got comfortable with being able to drink. Now, during the stressful time working at Valve, I was doing a lot of drinking, a lot of social drinking, drinking every day, drinking on my own, during lunch, after work with lunch, you know, you meet with people, you go to conventions, like, it just became, every event became around alcohol. Then we'd go on vacation, which was a week of drinking, and it really got out of hand. So I had to put the brakes on it, and I gave myself like a month. I was like, let me just stop for like a month and see what happens. And luckily, I didn't have withdrawals or any other kinds of issues. I was able to do it. But then with that clarity came sort of all my mother's issues and stuff. And looking back on that. And that's where the story kind of started from.
Wow, man. I mean, it's interesting. And again, I think you have the advantage of both writing and drawing it that the imagery that you put in there, along with the real moments as well and everything, it's cool. It's interesting.
I'd like to do more with Wild Rover eventually, because I kind of set up a story where I'm kind of owning the issue of alcoholism in there, you know, instead of trying to make a statement about it's, you know, it's right or it's wrong or does it the families or blah, blah, blah or whatever, I just kind of take it into its own direction where it's an alcoholic hero has to battle his demons literally by drinking them to death. Which I'm not ever suggesting anybody do, but this character does. And I think it's an interesting take on it. And also at the time, besides the therapy and stuff, I was reading a lot of independent books that were people expressing their issues with themselves or their experiences. And one of the biggest influences on me then was a book called 676 Apparitions of Killoffer.
Okay.
Have you ever read this?
No. Go on.
It's an insane book about a guy fighting himself. There's no words in it. And it's like 64 pages of him fighting. Well, there are words in it, I'm sorry, but it's largely silent. And it's about him fighting himself and fighting his own demons. And it just gets way out there. So I would suggest anybody get a chance to check that out. And I was reading that and a bunch of other sort of self-examination books and figuring out, well, how can I take a sort of mainstream approach that I have for stuff and marry it with the sort of, David B. self-examination kind of comics. Like, what's the gap
between
that stuff and what a mainstream comic is? Even though I'm not completely mainstream, I'm way more mainstream than this stuff is. And that's where a lot of that came from, and I'm having a really good time with it.
No, well, it's interesting, and it sounds like it's cathartic for you as well. It reminds me too of the other side of the coin of what Dean Haspiel does with Billy Dogma, because it's, you know, and sometimes things are a little lighter in what Dean is doing with that, but they have their dark moments as well, and that's why it's like, you know, Dean is kind of more indie comic first, and like I said, you know Wild Rover comes off more like again, forgive me, but I mean this is a compliment, a Vertigo kind of feel to it.
Okay.
And because maybe, you know, I would say because of your noir work and because of even your little ventures in mainstream and stuff like that, yours is more of a classic storytelling style, and I think Dean. And, you know, even when he was doing stuff with Harvey Pekar or even his own stuff, it always starts more in that four-panel cartoon realm.
Well, Dean's an amazing creator. And, you know, again, there's a lot of that type of stuff that was very influential to me.
Okay.
And, you know, it's good to reach outside of your comfort zone and to look at, you know, obviously, you know, novels and real life and all these other experiences that you could bring into, but I really have a huge admiration for a lot of these types of books that are very personal and sort of art first and commerce later.
Understood.
Yeah, you know, which, yeah, I mean, I could spend hours walking around Floating World and, you know, look at these books and buy a ton of stuff if I can, and I look at that stuff and I'm pretty soaked into that world.
Yeah, that's cool, and I also think Dark Horse Presents itself as an anthology book has become this kind of – this is where all the performers can go and do the music they want to do and not worry as much about how will it come, because Neil Adams is doing that with Blood.
Yeah.
Francesco's getting to do his Black Beetle stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing Wild Rover. Even Kelly Sue and Noto coming up on Ghost I think is interesting, and everybody's kind of – you know, it's great. You know, Steranko, they did a little bit of finally,
but
you know,
Dark
some
Horse
new.
Presents, like being in Dark Horse Presents is a huge honor, not just because of what the book stands for and what they've done, but I was reading it, you know, back in the day in the 80s when it was coming out, and I think it had a formative effect on me, which was while I was reading Peter Parker and X-Men and, you know, all these other books, I was reading Dark Horse Presents. I didn't realize that I was getting an education or a sort of subliminal influence from outside of the box thinking when it comes to comics, and it's really affected and kind of guided a lot of my decisions. You know, I like dipping my toe into the mainstream, you know, Marvel and DC world, and I love playing with those toys, but I always find that my ideas are always way more creator-owned driven, and it's not because, oh, it's all, you know, I'm a flag-waving creator-owned guy, but it's just I think I was just very influenced more by not knowing it at the time, but you know, the stories that were from Dark Horse Presents or Nexus being a creator-owned book or Concrete, sure. You know, these slightly off-kilter stories. I don't think I ever set out to do that stuff, but that's kind of what happened from reading those things. So it's kind of a big deal for me to get to be in Dark Horse Presents because it was something that was obviously formative to what I do.
Very cool. And it's two parts, and it starts in 115 and then also 116, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, July and August, I want to say, right? Or Dark Horse Presents is monthly.
Yeah,
very
and
cool.
And digital. No, they do a very good job with their digital comics, too.
Oh, that's cool. I've been buying the books, although I'm seeming to have that same problem with you. I'm looking at a purge very soon of a bunch of books and stuff like that. But, I want to talk about the digital stuff in a second, but let's talk about Victories because, man, I'll tell you, the preview art looks fantastic. It was great to see it at Emerald City, and then also at C2E2 at the Diamond Retailer Summit, they certainly took a moment to talk about the series as well. So, you've called it kind of a postmodern superhero story, and tell us
the
pitch.
Yeah, I think one of the great lessons that I think that were kind of missed off of Watchmen, and, you know, everybody's been talking about the before Watchmen stuff, and I think the greatest lesson that was kind of forgotten from Watchmen was the fact that you can tell any kind of story with superheroes. And I know Alan Moore doesn't love superheroes, and that probably wasn't his message. You can tell, you know, any kind of story with superheroes, but that's what I got from it. You know, when I read Watchmen, it doesn't feel like a superhero book. I mean, there's hardly any, you know, fights, or there's not a lot of people running around on rooftops and doing all kinds of cool superhero stuff. But he told an amazing story that used this, you know, superheroes as an analogy for 10 different things because it's such a deep, wide pool of what he was writing there. And while I know we're trying to be Alan Moore because that's a trap, it was an influence, that idea that you can tell any story. That's what I got from Watchmen, that you can do anything with superheroes. And people look at superheroes as being limited. I think it's only because we're self-limiting them to basically, you know, cops and robbers stories. And I think they could be so much more. And so when I read these other indie comics, I'm like, these can be done just as well as superhero comics. And because I love superheroes and I love the imagery and the iconology of them, but I don't like a lot of the stories. And I think because, you know, they're just not personal enough. And, you know, maybe we went too far in Victories. Victories is a very, very personal story. The game came out of therapy. You know, a lot of my issues come out of a kind of tumultuous childhood. A lot of the stuff was going on at the same time that I was learning to draw and learning to fall in love with comics. So I think that a lot of my issues always followed me. Every time I would draw a page of comics, some of the damage of growing up has always been there, like in the shadows. So I had this idea of how can I put that on paper? How can I express that idea? So what if there's a superhero whose powers all come from a sort of damaged background? What if his origins themselves are damaging? And so every time he uses his powers, every time that he is who he is or expresses himself or does the things that he loves best, it's always in the shadow of the things that damage him the most. And I thought that was a really interesting way to deal with a character and some of my own issues. So that's kind of where it starts out. But it's basically a superhero story as the B story and the personal story as the A story, but it's all kind of wrapped up in the etymology of superheroes.
Very interesting. And again, when I heard about the story, and I know that it's set in the now, I'm assuming it's set in the now, Parliament of Justice came to mind. And how because there's another mass figure that clearly had issues. And,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't your conventional – you know, this is obviously more of a swashbuckling story, I guess, maybe mass swash, like almost like an anti-Zorro in a sense, or,
Parliament, maybe we can get more into the future, the timing's right, but Parliament was a lot of my commentaries on the problems I had with superheroes, the way they're depicted, you know, especially if it's a superhero that stands for sort of truth, justice in the American way. Which is there's a great quote by Richie Havens, the singer, where he says that Superman stands for truth, justice, and the American way. And he says, but I thought truth and justice was the American way. So there's this great, you know, there's this implication already into the hypocrisy of somebody who puts themselves above the law or puts themselves in a high moral position that we see all the time in life. What happens every time somebody does that? They're usually a child molester, they're screwing around their wife. They're usually the worst people, the ones spouting the moral high horse. Because if you're doing the right thing, you don't have to yell at other people about what they're doing. Because it's not always on your mind, you know. Superheroes are often, I guess that's why I kind of like the anti-heroes more, because they embrace the side of them that is who they truly are, which is, it varies, but it's definitely not a moral high ground place. And a character like Batman, who stands for justice, every time he touches a piece of evidence of any character, of any villain, he's contaminating it for the justice system. Can you imagine if you're the prosecutor for the Joker? Like, how can you prosecute that case when the person who found the evidence took it out of the room, brought it back to a secret location, did his own test on it, then told you that it was the Joker who did it, and then gives you the proof? You know, imagine trying to defend that. You know, every time Batman walks into a room, he's screwing up the case for the justice system. You know, there should be no Arkham Asylum because there wouldn't be anybody locked up in it. And yet he's standing for you know, fighting against crime. He's the biggest hypocrite out there. And I love Batman, but I find that aspect of him tremendously interesting.
So I imagine I saw the one piece of promotional art, and you're dealing with familiar archetypes. Is that a fair way to kind of address some of the heroes that we will be seeing?
Not so much in Victories. I mean, there's definitely a visual similarity to any character like Batman or Black Panther or the Fox, sort of, you know,
okay,
the ninja guys and stuff. I definitely admit that, but that is not my commentary on Batman. Hopefully I'll just get to do a Batman story someday where I can actually do that in the right way. That's the only way to do that kind of stuff. You can't stand back and criticize characters and companies. The best thing to do is actually make your statement on them.
Didn't you do a teeny tiny, like, Batman Black and White or some sort of small few pages of Batman, or no?
I did. I can't remember what the hell it was.
Okay.
I did a Catwoman story.
Okay.
And, you know, actually, I think that's it. Yeah, I have not officially drawn Batman yet. Hopefully.
Okay, because that's – all right, that's like Brian with Citizen Wayne and stuff like that. I know it's like, you know, very, very little, but – I thought a little teensy bit, but there you go.
I think it'll happen someday. I mean, I'm working with DC on other stuff, and I have a decent relationship with them. So,
very good.
Yeah, it'll be a matter of timing.
Okay. All right. That's cool. Well, this is great that I really am happy that you are doing these creator-owned things, because I, you know, honestly, Mike, as along with Powers, Hammer of the Gods, Parliament of Justice, Ship of Fools. I mean, that's the thing. It was always fun seeing your original stuff, I really enjoyed the Hammer of the Gods was really kind of exciting back in its time. You know, honestly, it's been so long since we've talked. History Channel is doing Ancient Aliens. Are you watching that with any regularity?
I love Ancient Aliens. I love crazy stuff, man. I love crazy stuff. I'm not a person who and actually, I think last time we spoke, I was starting up a Mice Templar, which is starting to wrap itself up.
Okay.
Now there's just four or five trades that out at this point. But we were talking about mythology at the time.
Yes.
And
yes.
I've recently come to this sort of idea about modern mythology. You know, I know everybody kind of wants to say superheroes are modern mythology, and I'm kind of on the fence about that for various reasons. But one of the things that I did realize recently, and you're speaking of ancient aliens and stuff, is I think our new true modern mythology is conspiracy. You know, whether you're talking about JFK or 9/11 or the Bush presidency or the current administration or whatever,
sure.
The amount of like of belief and almost religious fervor that people are putting into conspiracies now, and again, it could be UFOs and all that stuff. That seems to be like the modern mythology, because it's really reflecting how people think about society now and what their place is in it. I'm not really fully formed the idea, but I'm finding ways to. So I've got another story, of course, I want to do that deals with that stuff. And it's less to do with the actual conspiracies themselves, but it's the mindset that goes behind people who believe that stuff.
That makes sense, though, because you're right. That is, these stories were originally told to show how the world works.
And
this is why
they're trying to do now. They're trying to explain why they have no money,
right,
or why they're going bankrupt, or why,
right,
you know, America seems to be falling apart. It has to be somebody's fault. It's the gods. The gods being CIA and, you know, the
banking power, yeah.
Yeah, and all that stuff. The Federal Reserve, which isn't an actual branch of the federal government, and crazy shit like that. And, you know, that's what people are trying to do now, find ways to explain why the world is so shitty.
Oh man, we got to call George Norrie and.
I love our Bell's George Norrie show and I listen to that's a lot of sources for a lot of stories.
Oh man, no, I love that stuff too. Okay, so you're a time traveler in Utah. Tell me more. Go on.
Do you know about the Area 51 caller?
A specific guy on Norrie's show? No.
So there was a very, very famous incident that happened on the Art Bell show in the 90s.
Okay.
And it was called the Area 51 caller. He had his open lines and said, anybody who was a former employee of Area 51, feel free to call in. Tell me your story. So there's this call that comes in. This guy's talking about how the government knows there's coming cataclysms and they're safe places, but, you know, they want to decrease the population and all that sort of classic crazy anti-government conspiracy stuff.
Sure.
And then he sounds like he's getting shot, and then they go off the air for like an hour. Like he doesn't lose connection from the show for like 5 minutes. It's gone for like an hour. So this is like one of the largest events that happens in the Art Bell show's history. And this phone call is called the Area 51 caller, and it has been on a Tool album. It's been remixed multiple times onto YouTube with different songs and stuff. It's been used as a plot device for this film called Lunopolis. It's just been all over the place. And that caller, which nobody could ever know who it actually was or actually prove it, that caller was Brian Glass, the writer of...
No way.
Yeah, and we were doing Ship of Fools at the time. This call, he calls in on the East Coast, that's like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. And Brian calls in and does this, and then, you know, the channel, the station loses touch with the satellite or some crazy stuff. Like, it wasn't just Art, like, pushing a button and saying, oh, this is a really good time. Like, they legitimately lost connection. Because, like, an hour or 15 minutes or whatever it was, that's money. You know,
sure.
That's real airtime.
Oh, no, that's
dollars.
They have to the advertisers aren't running, the commercials aren't running and stuff, and no, a lot of refunds have to happen, absolutely.
Yeah, and then Brian was a little freaked out, because, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, he does this crazy call, and then that happens, and he was like, did I accidentally say something a little too close to the truth? So it's just crazy that there's this big conspiracy thing, and it's been hovering around the show that so many of us love, and have this nice little connection to it, and Brian will always... be a hero in my eyes for doing that.
That's hilarious. Now another reason to get Brian on the show.
That's very funny.
I had no idea. That's crazy,
I think we'll definitely have to find a place for that to work itself into one of these stories in the future. Yeah.
And then the NSA showed up at Brian Glass's house. Holy shit.
Well, what was funny was the next day after he called me, there was a helicopter hovering over my house for 15 minutes. I'm not kidding. And so, like, again,
get
I was
really
here. Freaked out. No, it really
wow.
happened.
That's but, awesome. Oh,
but
my God.
We find out later that there was a car accident nearby. And it was the ambulance helicopter thing trying to find a place to land. But it's a perfect sort of example of what happens with conspiracies and paranoia and how coincidence and facts can line up to create a new sense of reality for people, which is where I think, you know, so many of the conspiracy stuff comes from, why some people can believe in it so much, because there's always a kernel of truth to any of the stuff. Like, the crazy 9/11 stuff, the kernel of truth is that, yes, the CIA worked a lot with terrorists to do dry runs of bombing things, and there was weird tests going on that day and stuff, but then they'll extrapolate that into George Bush wants to kill America so that he can
right.
be a hero or some crazy stuff. I don't even like George Bush, and that's still insane. You know,
yeah, I agree on both of those counts. Yes.
Yeah, but my own personal experience has shown me how easy it is to connect the dots and come up with the wrong picture.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Man, all I wanted to talk about was the guy with the crazy hair on Ancient Aliens and stuff from Legendary Times.
Oh, that guy's awesome. He's
great.
He's so excited about his ideas. I love it. You want to listen to what he says. But Joe Hill is definitely the craziest thing out of the smallest thing on that show. Which is, you know, you can tell they don't really want to come to these conclusions. Sometimes they're like, we need to fill this 2 hours, you know.
It is, honestly, it is one of my favorite shows. And when Meltzer's Decoded comes back.
Oh, I love Brad Meltzer's Decoded. What's funny is I hate to say this, I missed all of his comics. I didn't know he was a comic book guy. I knew him from the show. And then, like, I was reading Twitters or something where he was writing comics. I was like, oh, this is another, you know, TV or writer guy trying to be a comic book writer. And, you know, I didn't realize it was the other way around. I'm a huge fan of him and his books and his comics. And that show is amazing. That's another great conspiracy show.
Absolutely. Exactly. And I always love the fact that, you know, Ancient Aliens is usually his setup show. And he loves it, too. And that's what's fantastic. So, yeah, I'm like, excellent, man. Yeah,
keep an eye out on Powers. There's a character. We're going to name Meltzer. We'll see if it goes through or not.
That's
fantastic. He does something really horrible. So I don't know if ultimately it'll stay in or not.
So you guys can, like, name a school after me like you did in that issue of Powers and stuff. But, it, you know, yeah, God forbid you put Meltzer's name in there. You had Warren Ellis doing the drive around and everything, for God's sake.
That was the best. That was,
absolutely.
We'll never beat that. That happened too soon.
So every now and then I gotta, like, you know, say, all right, so where are we at with Powers and stuff like that? Man, 10 years, which is insane. And it's even been longer now. Now, are we on 12 already? 13 years? 13?
Well, issue 13 would be, it was going to be issue 13, but that, now it's Powers FBI number one. So, excuse me. So we're now relaunching the book, but issue... I mean, there's a new number one, but it's basically, so in 1 month it's issue 11, next month it'll be the Powers FBI branch. And the reason is, when you read Powers 11, you'll understand that that is the end of a chapter in the Powers chapter in a big way. We've done this several times where I think we have written the end of Powers. Like the storyline will get so big, and it has nothing to do with whether we want to do Powers or not. We will write characters into a corner. We constantly will paint, you know, that idiom of what's the idiom? It's the wrong word. But it's that idea of taking your characters and putting them in the worst possible situation. You do that enough times, and you're going, like, how are they going to get out of this? You know, Dina, you know, becoming a, you know, not quite a serial killer, but she goes off the deep end. Other moments like that where I think that's it. You know, there's no way for us to get out of this. And when you read issue 11 of Powers, you'll understand why we went to everything had to change after that.
Wow.
So I'm just about finished drawing that issue right now.
Interesting. Okay. When there's a game changer in Powers, things get interesting. So that's cool.
I can probably feel it'll be interesting.
All right, very cool.
Yeah, and I thank everybody who's hung in there through our crazy hiatus, you know, which it tied in with, you know, Brian working on the pilot, and I was working at Valve at the same time. So it felt like we were always working on Powers. I guess it just didn't feel like we're shipping Powers.
I understand.
And shipping Powers are two very different things.
You know, honestly, I think kind of like other creators with their creator-owned stuff, I do think there is an understanding with the audience as well. I hope there is, and I think the majority of the audience does understand that. You know, sometimes with those creator-owned books, there has to be this time of, especially for you as an artist. You know,
there is, but ultimately, and Brian, I feel the same way about this. Ultimately, it's not cool. You know what I mean? I mean, there is an understanding there, but. People have spent a lot of money on Powers. They spent a lot of time, a lot of interest, and devoted themselves to it. And, you know, us getting the books out on time is just as important as actually creating the books. So we're spending lots of time on Powers, making Powers, writing Powers, coming up with new ideas for Powers. But actually getting the books out is a whole other issue, and we're working on that.
I understand. And I'm glad to see, too, because – I almost wish all of comics would just go to numbering a story arc, and instead of worrying about, you know, issue 796 of Batman, it's, you know, chapter 5 of the Judas Goat, and as soon as that's over, then we're going to start with another number one.
Yeah, that's the upside to our crazy schedule is that, you know, if I'm drawing an issue and I get the script and it's 24 issues or 24 pages, but I want to make it 30 pages, I can do that. You know, we have the freedom to do anything we want with the book, and that's what's made it daring and surprising. Even at times when nobody wanted to be dared or surprised, like in the monkey fucking issue, we still got to do that, you know? Satan's cock was another good example. You know, there was just shocking stuff that we got to do with the characters. That that's the trade-off for the you know, crazy shipping schedule. Is that it is a book where there are no rules. Even our own rules get to be broken.
And I remember too when I saw art when you were you had a female bad girl zapping her nether region.
Oh yeah, that was the only actual argument that Brian and I ever had over the book was the masturbation episodes. Yeah. I forget what it was about. It was like whether it was too explicit or not, or if it didn't make sense. I don't quite remember, but yeah, that and Satan's cock was a big thing.
That's cool, man. No, that's excellent. Very
but,
funny.
But no, we're you know, especially now that I'm not working at Valve anymore, I need to have a regular income. So Powers has to start coming out on a regular schedule, or else I'm going to be drawing this from a back alley at some point. So that, you know, we're getting the issues out, we're putting them together, they're looking really nice, we're very happy with it, and things on the show right now are still going forward too, but I think we're finding a better balance between paying attention to the show and getting the book together.
Very cool. Tell me about the show. What is the status right now? Is there a word on an air date for the pilot?
Well, the pilot was shot, they're going to reshoot it. We actually like the pilot, but FX isn't going to put out a good pilot. They need to put out a great pilot.
Interesting. Okay.
And especially because of their own history of, you know, filming and refilming pilots. They've done it several times. But also, this is the first time they're doing a real genre piece. You know, something like Archer doesn't count because it's animated. And, you know,
okay.
It's so far out into its own world. But this is the first time they're doing something... That's a true genre piece outside of, you know, crime and stuff. So you can't make any missteps on this. This has to be 100%. And I understand that, and I appreciate it because I don't want anything that's going to embarrass me or the book. So they're going to refilm the pilot. Right now they have Chick Eagley and several other writers are actively, and Brian, they're actively working on Power scripts. It's got new scripts that were ordered, and they're working on a new pilot, and it's got a space out in the Sony lot and stuff. So, you know, things are happening, and we'll see where they go from here. So FX is very dedicated to the book and or to the show, and just keep our fingers crossed. The main thing we have to do is just concentrate on getting the issues out because the comic is something we can control completely. But, you know, film and television is something else. And we've been living with this as a project for almost as long as Powers. So, you know, at this point, we're kind of nonplussed by it.
No, I understand. And no, I think you guys have, you know, shown a good amount of patience and also know the value of being with FX. And like you say, I mean, literally, they're batting not 1,000, but damn close to it. And
yeah.
It's because of the care they put into all of their pilots, and even the shows that don't make it beyond a season, like that Lights Out boxing show from last year.
Yeah, it was a great show.
It was an absolutely great show, and also Terriers, another great example of a wonderful show that, mm-hmm. you know, at least you can count on quality. So, and I understand there's only so much you can say, but are they recasting then for a new pilot? Is it going to be a totally new production from the ground up, or is it just, we need a better script and we need a better head on this?
I'm pretty sure we'll, because other actors have gone on to, you know, make other commitments and stuff, and you can't hold them down for an indefinite period of time. So, yeah, I think they're going to be recasting it. I look forward to that process again. That was really interesting. I've never worked on anything like that before.
All right, now this time if you guys do shoot in Chicago again, I'm going to demand to get on the set because, seriously.
Absolutely.
No, it's all right, man. I did get to see a little bit of shooting on the Saturday that after Brian had left, David showed me around.
Oh well, what's insane too is how quickly that stuff is done. How quickly they shoot and move. It seems like when I got noticed that, you know, they were going to start shooting, we started making plans. And it seemed like a week later, we're like, holy crap, we have to get out there now because it's going to be done. I got out there to see some of it, and we had a really good experience. It was amazing sitting there with Brian in the director's chair, watching them, direct Powers and, act the character. The actors were acting out the parts, and that was crazy. It was really it's an experience I can't really put words on, but I was very happy that we had it. Hopefully we'll have it again.
Yeah, I hope so, man. No, really. I think it's a good fit for FX, and like I say, they know what they're doing with television, so I really hope that everything gels and we get at the very least a pilot movie that airs on TV and, hopefully a series that follows.
Yeah, and it's not, Brian and I, we have the books, we have lots of other stuff we're going to put together.
Yes.
And it's been a great experience already, and I look forward to more of it. And I just finished watching The Shield. I kind of fell behind. I didn't watch the last two seasons, so we just
stuff,
and that was like made me feel very proud to be in the hands of Chick Eagley and FX.
That's really cool, man. No, fantastic, and I wish you guys luck on that. And you guys have had pedigree guys working on Powers. That's the thing. They're certainly not sending you any dogs. So
no,
if they're still not
amazing, hopefully, obviously the actual show will get made, but if it doesn't, we have the opportunity to show people the pilot. People are going to be peeing on themselves. It's a beautiful looking thing.
Very cool, man. Very, very cool. Now we talked a little bit about digital, and you obviously have some thoughts on what's happening with comic books now and where things are going. So let's talk about that a little bit. Where do you see yourself in the current digital comic landscape?
I see myself with everybody else. You're just kind of caught in between the gap of, where comics are, where comics are going, what's happening with the digital world. I don't believe that print is dead. I don't believe print will ever be dead. And we kind of like saying that, and sometimes we even say it as like a joke or something, but it won't be. We're just looking for where that common ground is and where the audience is for digital. I never wanted to read things digitally. It just happened in a very natural, organic way. And I think that's happening for most people. Reading a comic book on your phone was fun the first time I did it. And by the fourth time I did it, I decided I didn't want to do it anymore. And then once you can get a device like a Switch or an iPad or any of those devices, and it became natural, it became something that felt right. I was like, oh, this is great. This is how I want to experience comics now. I don't know where it's going to settle out. We'll have to see. It's growing every day. We'll just have to see where it's going. I hope businesses and especially companies start making better choices about how they get word out that you can read comics digitally. I think that's the biggest issue right now. Is letting all the people who are, downloading the Captain America movie to know that on the same device you can download the Captain America app, or, if you're downloading Green Lantern or Batman, that on the same book, on the same device, you can also read the comic. I think most people who are buying those films don't know that that's possible. So that's a big hurdle for us to get over.
Well, and it seems now more than ever that Warner Brothers and Disney should be working hand in hand, and there should be that kind of awareness on the tablet. If you buy a movie, that there should be kind of
you'd think.
Well,
but if you go to iTunes, you can download the Batman trailer, and then under that there'll be the Batman books, like novelizations. Then there'll be a bunch of podcasts of everybody
right
with their thoughts on it. But there's no link to the comic app, and I know that. Or not to the app, but there's no link to actually read the comic next to the Batman film on iTunes, which is obviously the leading digital platform. Warner Brothers, whose film is called Batman, who owns Batman, would see that would be something they should address. But it's still not been addressed, and I'm very frustrated by that, especially after the relaunch of 52 and all that. It was such a great effort to get people to come in fresh again, and then there was an opportunity there that I think that isn't lost. I mean, they'll do it again. There's always a chance. Hopefully
absolutely.
Batman still comes out, they'll do something like that, and Marvel will follow suit.
We're in the midst of it now with Avengers and everything, and
Thank God for Avengers, man.
Yeah, no kidding. I obviously you've seen it as well.
Yeah.
And I thought it was terrific. I think this might be my first opportunity to talk about Avengers since it's come out. I got to see a preview right before it opened.
Well,
so,
I'm assuming you are just as much in love with it as everybody else is who's seen it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I to the point, too, that the few critics that do have problems with it, I find really interesting. And I think – and honestly, this is going to sound kind of nerdish to say, but I almost think that they don't quite understand the superhero film genre yet and what it is.
When talking to Charlie, we saw with some friends of ours who aren't comic book fans. And they didn't like the film. So I was assuming that was going to be kind of the experience across the board. But when I asked on Twitter, like, what did your non-comic book fans, friends think of the Avengers? And after being yelled at for the idea of somebody having non-comic book friends, I was really shocked that most people were like, my mom loved it. My friends loved it. And they, you know, even the things they didn't understand, they were able to wrap their heads around. So I was really surprised at how many people who are not indoctrinated into comics seem to still, you know, embrace the film. And the numbers show it. I mean, you know, the film did, record-breaking numbers.
Well, I'm interested to hear what your friends didn't like. I think the reason why the majority of people still like the movie is in its simplicity. Because the problem the critics seem to have with it is, okay, you set up what the problem is. They get together and they solve it. That's it. And yes, there's some good characterization and banter in between, but I'm seeing that a lot of the critics are like, it's too straightforward. And then you get the wall of CGI effects for 20 minutes at the end. And it's but that's what the people want. And I think they know that that's what they're going in for. It's their spectacles rather than, you know,
it's
classic.
It's a spectacle in a good way.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, it's not a spectacle in like a – a mind-mashing way, like the Transformers films. You look at that, and
exactly.
You know, they're spectacles, but they're, you know, you feel like somebody just punched you in the head for 10 minutes when you came out of that. I love the Avengers, though. I thought they pulled everything off. But my friends who didn't like it had those exact same points that you just mentioned. But they are in the minority. It seems like there's a certain amount of people that just aren't gonna get the film. And, you know, I think that's fine, especially in wake of how well it's being accepted. I was also shocked. I was very, very happy with how it's been portrayed in the media. I was watching an episode of Nightline before it came out, and they did a piece on the Avengers. And not once did they do like a Biff Bam Pow thing or, you know, any of the like tongue-in-cheek comic book stuff that you usually see to denigrate the field. I was really,
sure.
really pleased. So I'm starting to see a change in that. You're starting to see people understand that. Yes, superheroes are fun and all that, but they're not jokes. You know, it's a genre.
Exactly, and I think it's a genre that's also still, even though it's been, it's right before I called you. In fact, I was talking to a friend, and you know, people always wonder where do you start this superhero film genre era that we're in, and some people say the Spider-Man movie, but I honestly think it started with Blade, because I thought Blade, in the face of Batman and Robin's parody feeling and Steel and all this crap, that was Marvel's first try on a smaller scale to take one of their heroes and try and do a cool movie. And no, it's not a joke. This is a cool action movie, and Blade is a perfect character to start. And then, of course, you built on Bryan Singer's X-Men, and I think Raimi was that step three of, okay, now enough is right that we can come out with a big movie and have a big success. But I still think that the genre is still kind of finding its feet, and finding its way even in a storytelling sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there are huge pitfalls with the superhero genre when you're doing films. And when you fall into those pitfalls, I think they're much deeper and harder than the pitfalls of other genres, like the spy thing or something. You know, it can be downright embarrassing when it doesn't work. Whereas other films, you just go, oh, that sucked. It's like, this sucked and it was embarrassing, you know? do you know if DC is going to be doing, looking at the Marvel... the model for the way that they've influenced the films, whether they're producing them themselves or the fact that they're just very involved in the filmmaking? Is DC going to do more of that in the future? Do you know if that's happening? I have no idea. So
I honestly don't either. Clearly, Green Lantern. Yeah, I have no inside, you know, friends over at DC that are passing me any notes. I mean, it's obvious that Green Lantern was an attempt to kind of get their house in order, and instead got a film by committee that, you know, failed in, unfortunately, a lot of ways. I think the Nolan films are so insular that he really does call the shots. You know, that's what...
I realized recently, those films are the Batman Nolan films are really good films. I do like them. But they don't feel like Batman movies to me for some reason. And I think I realized that recently when I was looking at some of the newer, like, photos of him and stuff, was that he looks like a Transformer. Like, he barely looks like Batman. And then the films feel more like this should be, like, a CIA, James Bond kind of thing with, you know, these kind of over-the-top villains than Batman. Like, and maybe it's my own personal taste, but while I like the films, they don't feel the way that the Spider-Man films feel like Spider-Man, or this Avenger film feels like the Avengers, you know. Even the way Green Lantern felt like Green Lantern, like, while it wasn't a good film, it serviced the fanboys, you know, and had those moments and stuff. But the Batman movies are so insular. They're very much Nolan's film as opposed to a Batman film. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I guess I'm just waiting around for my Batman movie again.
Interesting. Because I like them. I like them a lot. And I do think that they get a lot of the stuff right. They go off on their own, just like Burton's good films went off on their own. But I don't know. It still feels like Batman to me. And I am interested to see, you know, obviously about this last chapter. But, I mean, that's the thing. Outside of the success with Batman, DC seems to still have trouble. But again, I think you got to look at Green Lantern as a first attempt, and that is something they can learn from. And I do think they have a lot of smart people to call on to make good movies.
Hopefully the Avengers will put the pressure on them to, you know,
figure
out what is going on right with the Marvel template for making films or approaching them. Because even stuff like the Hulk film, I haven't seen any of the Punisher films. I've been told some of them are good. But it seems like anything that they're involved in, like, is pretty good, like, not embarrassing, you know, the bad films, well, stuff that they're not doing.
No, you're right. I mean, and, you know, the Bana film aside, the Eric Bana Hulk film and stuff like that, the Punisher films, I didn't think they were that good, either of them. As you said, that the Batman film didn't feel like Batman. Thomas Jane, I think, is great. There were a lot of good people working on the Punisher. It just didn't feel like a Punisher movie to me. I didn't like War Journal. I think some people do like it. I didn't care for it.
Was a little more interesting, but I hadn't seen either.
But we'll see. I mean, you know, the good news is, honestly, there's never an end to this. Like, where, like, well, Marvel's won the race, I guess the game's over. It's like, no, it's every year there's going to be a challenge of putting something out there. And
I
both
do
companies
love the idea of not being afraid to reinvent the character, you know, to, like, the idea that they can do Daredevil again. Or the idea that, you know, they went back and I was against the reboot of Spider-Man, because even though that film was 10 years old, it still holds up visually and story-wise and stuff, but I saw the latest trailer and it kind of won me over. I was like, wow, this is really different, but it feels right. It feels good.
Well, just like X-Men First Class, I had no expectations for that, and I thought that was the best superhero movie last year. Honest, and I loved Thor, loved Captain America, but I really thought X-Men First Class was the most fun.
I liked it a lot. I was surprised. I didn't think I was going to like it, but I definitely did. And, you know, the way they, you know, with Batman films, again, going back and looking almost like James Bond films, where there's only continuity if they need it to be. So I'm excited. I really want them to do a good Daredevil film. That's the thing about that. Really want
them. Me too. Although I do like the director's cut a little bit better than what we got in the theater.
I've not watched it, but I think one of these days I'm gonna have to sit down with a couple beers and watch that Daredevil extended version.
Yeah, it's honestly, there's that whole Coolio subplot, and you really see more of Matt in court, and it explains the Kingpin's reason for being a little bit more, and it was a big mistake, and thankfully, I think we're seeing this in a lot of movies now. I think a lot of movies were afraid for a long time to be 2 hours, and really went for that 140 minute mark
you have to tell where the character's coming from. You know, in a normal film, that would happen in the third act, but you don't want, you know, 2 acts of the character not in costume. I mean, that's what we're there for.
Yep. And again, that That's why I think this genre, again, is playing by its own rules, because Roger Ebert's critique of Avengers was a lot of these films are feeling very formulaic. And it's like, yeah, Roger, just like most Westerns kind of have their own formula.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Honestly, and I love Roger Ebert. I think he's a smart and great critic. But again, I think some of these critics just can't quite get a handle on the superhero film genre.
That is going to happen, and as fans, we have to accept that there are some people that are just not going to get it, and that's fine. You know, I'm not interested in political thrillers or
I like political thrillers.
No, actually, I do like political thrillers. That was just the first. There are certain types of films just not into it and stuff, and I can understand that, and I'll let people have those opinions. But speaking of Daredevil and Elektra, you know what I did like about those films is the documentaries at the end of those films. The extras, they're amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Those are so good. The Daredevil one and the Elektra one, where Klaus Janson was showing his Daredevil pages and what him and Frank were doing, and there was interviews with all of our friends, David Mack, Ryan Bendis, and everybody else. And those are so good. And I keep those films on DVD. Because just like my comics, I've digitized most of my stuff at this point. So I have hardly any DVDs. But I kept those because the documentaries in there are so good.
No, I agree. And it drives me nuts. I wish that they would sell those bonus features on iTunes and stuff You know, because you're right, man. No, these are great little documentaries.
Yeah,
and now especially
burn them and stuff. I can't, I have to convert them because you can't get them on iTunes, which is separate for sure. They would make more money too.
No, and it's so, and honestly, especially given that Gene Colan passed away recently and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's right.
I mean,
he had a big interview in there in the Daredevil.
Yeah. Right, and I mean, that's the thing. It's like getting these guys. It's one of the reasons why I do Word Balloon, honestly, and that's why I like talking to the old guard as much as I like talking to new guys because, let's get these guys on tape and everything before it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
It's our history happening right next to us.
Yes, and then, now that we've got this opportunity and Citizen Media makes it easier and stuff like that, it's like, no, man, I want to, poor John Severin, I didn't get a chance to talk to him before he passed. Guys like that. I saw Qbert, and hopefully I'll be talking to him before the end of the year on Word Balloon. I saw him at C2E2 and set up time. So, yeah, we'll see.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, anyway, man, I think I've taken enough of your time, but I appreciate it as always. And
I'm getting sick of my own voice. I haven't heard it this much in a long time.
No, man. Well, it's again, I'm glad that we're back, and I'm sorry that it's been so long, but now we got new stuff to talk about coming up. With victories and
stuff.
Absolutely, man. Wild Rover starting in July, but already this week Takio, and later this month with Fred, a chapter of Hulk Smash. Very cool.
And I'm not sure when Powers 10 is shipping, but I know that production-wise it's all finished, and I think that's getting ready to finally get to the printer. And Powers 11 is all done, and working on Powers FBI number 1, almost wrapping that up right now. So all that stuff to look forward to.
Very, very cool, man. Yeah, so very cool stuff coming from Mike Oeming, and including some more other Bendis and Oeming creator-owned projects. So very cool.
Thanks so much. I should come back like in August or September. We can catch up on stuff.
That sounds good, man. No, I hope. What are you going to do convention-wise for the rest of the year?
I don't have much convention plans for the summer because my son comes out and stays with me during the summertime. So,
I try
to keep working all that stuff down to a minimum during that time period. Plus, I've done cons for so long that, when I go to a convention experience, I'm really trying to relive some of the glory days of conventions experiences I just don't get anymore. every time I go, I'm like, oh, why am I at home just working?
All right.
I love drawing comics, and I'm lucky that way. I'd rather be drawing comics than spending time at conventions, even though I have fun when I go. I'd still rather be making pages.
I understand, man. Well, we're glad you're back, man, and a lot of good stuff coming up, so keep it up, and we'll talk near the end of the summer, beginning of the fall.
Excellent. Thanks so much, John.
That's Mike Avon Oeming. A busy month of releases coming out and actually going into the summer as well. So check out all the new Oeming product coming up in the weeks ahead. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you that today's episode is sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Don't forget, if your orders are $50 or more, you receive free shipping from InStock Trades. And they give you a lot of reasons to reach that $50. How about a great collection of the Oz stories? Ozma of Oz from Scotty Young, Eric Schanauer. The trade paperback is 40% off. And the just $11.99 at InStockTrades.com. We were talking about Powers. You can get the premium hardcover volume 6, the sellouts at 40% off, $14.99. The Savage Sword of Conan. It's those great showcase and essential style collections of Conan stories that Dark Horse has been putting out. Volume 11, you can get it for just $11.59. Spider-Man Season 1, just $14.99 at InStockTrades.com. Check out all the deals there waiting for you. Fantastic values and new product always at a discount every week at InStockTrades.com. John Suntress saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon. As always, we couldn't do it without you. Great conversations coming up, more for the month of May, more for the summer. Very excited about some of the guests that are on the way, so just keep in tune right here. Questions or comments about the show, reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com, or you can follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon or under my own name at Facebook. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2012.